Seattle's Morning News, Monday morning, time for CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. You know, Patty and I do the happy hour menu anytime we can because we're seniors, we don't eat much.
Yeah.
But the other day, the House Rosé, happy hour price, $11 for a glass, which tells me that inflation is back.
I like the way that when you guys measure inflation, you do it with a very tangible item.
Yes.
Your wine, which
exactly.
is perfect. So here's the thing. Prices are going up. They just are. And this is, in a weird way, good news. The good news is that prices are rising, mostly because the global economy has picked up some steam. And that, in turn, has actually created a little pressure in the oil market. And that means that you see the price at the pump nearing $3 a gallon, which is for real. It also means that we have to start looking at whether or not people are making enough money to afford those price increases. Are their wages going up enough? And if they're not, is it that the idea that the tax cut savings that many Americans were supposed to feel are simply just going to pay for the stuff they've already been paying for a long time ago? So these are all questions that need to be answered in the economy right now.
Now, the inflation is mild, but it does mean something for people with adjustable mortgages, right?
Yes. I think that anyone who's got a loan is starting to feel the impact of this. So a loan can be a credit card, right? Because credit card companies are known for jacking their rates up. So maybe you won't have quite as many delicious offers at low rates. It may mean that you've got an adjustable rate mortgage. It's adjusting higher. If you have a lot of small business loans adjust with the general rate of interest. And so those loans will cost more. You'll also hear from folks who've been looking for a house. They're freaking out. They're saying, not only can I not find a house and prices are rising because there's such low inventory, but mortgage rates are higher today than they were a year ago. They're actually nearing a four-year high right now. So the cost of servicing debt is rising and will likely continue to rise. So I wouldn't delay it. Someone just called me recently and said, should I just wait for rates to go back to 4% on a 30-year fix? I'm like, who said they're going back to 4%?
Yeah.
It doesn't just happen because you want it to happen.
Yeah, as long as we're talking about home prices, sensitive subject here in Seattle, by the way, but you can get out of your private mortgage insurance if you can either prepay your mortgage or boost your equity in some way.
Yeah, this is a fantastic possibility for savings. A lot of people purchased homes with less than 20% down, and as a result, they've had to pay PMI. Now, sometimes your PMI payment just sort of rolls into your monthly bills and you don't pay attention to it, but the other side of those rising prices is that you might have more equity in your home. And if you've got at least 20% equity in your home, you actually may be able to, release yourself from PMI. Yeah. So what you've got to go through a lengthy process. I've got all the steps that you need to take on my website at JillOnMoney.com. The way it starts is simply to understand, what is your loan amount? And what is the appraised value of your house when you first got the mortgage? And what is it now? You want to put this in writing. You want to talk to your mortgage servicing company. See if you can get out of that monthly bill, because, boy, it will help you just, as I always say, like when you save money like that, is money flowing right to your bottom line. And it should help you pay for those higher gas prices.
And then you don't care about an $11 glass of wine.
Well, you never do, because in my mind, that's well worth it. See, there's a value for that, and that's the beautiful transaction you've just made.
Are we? If this is just, of course, sheer speculation.
Yes, I love doing that.
If these talks in North Korea turn out to be the spectacular, triumphant success that we all hope they'll be, it's Dow 30,000, right?
That's interesting. I don't know. I think that's a wait and see. I am very bad at predicting what will impact markets from a geopolitical standpoint, frankly, because the things that used to scare the you-know-what off of traders no longer does. So even when we were talking about Little Rocket Man, and there was a very tough talk going on about the North Koreans, the market didn't react negatively. So, do I think it would be better? Sure, it would be great not to worry about that. I still think what's moving markets right this second is that we've just come off of an we're coming off of an unbelievable corporate earnings season with corporate earnings up about 26% from a year ago. It's a huge number. It is a lot to do with that corporate tax cut. And although we didn't see markets go way higher on that news, it is now finally looking like the valuation of stocks has come back into line. Because remember, when we talk about valuation, we say the price of the stock relative to the earnings that the company's delivering.
Yes.
Well, guess what? The earnings are really good. So now that ratio looks much more in line with historic norms.
Good news. CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you.
Take care.
Today's the day. Seattle City Council votes on a proposed head tax amounting to about $500, which supposedly would make a significant dent in programs to dent in homelessness and support programs to end it. Hannah Scott's been following this story, and she's going to give us the rundown. And sounds like the mayor could veto this. Right?
It's possible. Depends on how it comes out of council today. So we went into Friday's council committee meeting with Mayor Durkin's plan to cut the tax from $500 a head to $250 for a total of $40 million a year on the table. It was a plan reps from the building trades and Amazon said Amazon supported and had promised to resume construction of its expansion projects should the city pass it out of the full council. But nearly everyone at that meeting opposed the idea.
$40 million is a disgrace. Yesterday, the Seattle Times published a study that shows we need at least $400 million every year on housing specifically to solve the housing crisis here in Seattle.
And five council members backed the original $75 million plan that puts the tax at $500 an employee. Four backed the mayor's plan. They tried to get to a compromise throughout the day, even hearing proposals for lowering to $350 a head and another that would have scrapped plans to turn it into a payroll tax and instead have it transition to a $180 a head tax in 2024. In the end, a split council passed the original version 5-4. The mayor all but promised a veto should it pass out of the full council that way, saying she would not be able to sign it. And after Friday's vote, council members who passed the original version stressed that they were going to meet with the mayor and others over the weekend to try to reach some sort of a compromise before the likely vote today. But Councilmember Mike O'Brien said it had to include enough affordable housing dollars and that the mayor's original proposal just didn't get that done.
We are willing to discuss alternatives, but it has to solve this crisis. And so we will continue to work, we will continue to discuss, we will look for other options. But to come out with a plan that is woefully inadequate, especially when it comes to housing, is not going to work.
Now, Council President Bruce Harrell, who had introduced the mayor's alternative version on Friday, said after the defeat that he still supported that smaller version.
Well, I think the $250 is pretty solid. I don't see $251 being a compromise. Now, in politics, everything could move a little bit. So all things are fair in the next couple of days.
So that was how they left Friday. A lot of the council members planning to meet over the weekend. I haven't heard any details about what may have happened over the weekend meetings. While many of them were meeting to find a compromise over the weekend, Councilmember Shama Sawant had other plans.
No Bezos Durkin deal! No Bezos Durkin deal! No Bezos Durkin!
About 250 of her supporters showed up for a tax Amazon rally in March that started on Capitol Hill.
Let's demand no backsliding on $75 million, no sunset clause.
Yeah!
Let's make this tax on big business the new $15 an hour.
And this formerly homeless woman was one of the speakers at that. She lives in a tiny house village and said that the tax is absolutely necessary.
There are those that would like to lower the $75 million we are fighting to raise to provide services to those in need and building housing. Amazon, who pays no to minimal tax, is complaining about how it will threaten their record profits, not taking into consideration the neighborhoods they have moved into. Their being here is part of what is driving up housing and property taxes to unaffordable rates.
Not everyone in that crowd agreed, though. There was a lone counter-protester in the crowd who told me that he voted for Sawant, but that she's wrong on this.
I feel like her Band-Aid policies, just, they're not going to work. We need a regional solution. And Seattle cannot bear the weight of this crisis on our own.
After the rally, the group marched on Amazon, sneaking through the streets from Capitol Hill through downtown Seattle to the Amazon Spheres, where Sawant had this message for her fellow council members.
Our message today is to the city council to stand strong, the majority to stand strong. If Mayor Durkin is threatening to veto, then let's call her bluff.
And she says, if the full council doesn't pass this as she wants, $75 million mark today, this fight is not over.
So regardless of what happens on Monday, I have no doubt in my mind that there is a housing justice movement in this town, and the billionaire class will have to reckon with it.
Everybody quotes this study in the Seattle Times, which said that we need 14,000 units of affordable housing. But it doesn't say that what it says is, I'll just quote from it here, that because of this gap in housing, the annual spending, public, private, or both, needs to double to $410 million. So what they're saying, what the study says is that you need to have private developers build housing as well, take the pressure off. Was there any discussion in the meeting about that, about making it easier for private developers to build more housing?
And they'd have to change some zoning, and there's things that have to go into that.
You're changing a lot of zoning essentially when you approve tent encampments and tiny house villages. So why wouldn't you want to change zoning to allow these micro apartments?
Well, and I know, don't get it. I don't feel that this came up in the head tax conversations, but there are other things that they're looking at as far as changing zoning. I know that the city council is looking at that right now. I think the big thing, though, you hit it on the head. You have to have private and the city pay for this, private and public. And, you know, even Dow Constantine came out late last week on Friday and said, let's slow this down and take a look at this and do this in a regional way. We need the state. We need the county. We need the city. We need the private. Everybody needs to be involved to do this.
Yeah. So assuming that the city council doesn't pass it with, if they pass with six votes and it's law, right?
Because that's veto proof. So
if they pass with five votes, the mayor vetoes it.
Yep.
And they take another vote. Is there a squishy sixth vote there, you know, to
at last
overturn
check,
the veto?
Lorena Gonzalez was asked this on Friday in their little post-press conference, and she kind of giggled, and she said she was optimistic, but nothing solid, nothing I've heard yet this morning. So I think that we'll see this play out in the council this afternoon, which that meeting starts at 2. We'll see. But they worked over the weekend. Otherwise, it's going to be all for nothing. They have to, and they could bounce this vote, by the way. They could decide to delay it today if they can.
And if it turns out there are six votes, are we expecting a statement from Amazon saying, okay, too bad for you, construction stops?
I don't know. We'll see. A lot of people that I've talked to think that their threat is an empty one. So it would be too difficult for Amazon to actually stop these expansion things and, you know, relocate a bunch of workers, things like that. So we'll see.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch is in for Colleen this week. There's a story from Mobile, Alabama, about a young man by the name of Trenton McKinley, age 13. He is riding in a trailer for some reason. It flips over. He strikes the concrete and fractures his skull in several places and basically goes brain dead. The parents are about to sign over his organs when suddenly the brain waves come back. It's one of the stranger cases I've seen of spontaneous recovery. So let's call in the doctor.
Agent Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. As I understand it, they could not find brain waves, correct?
Well, he was declared brain dead. It wasn't that they necessarily couldn't see brain waves.
Well, but they must have had some reason for declaring him brain dead then. I mean, it's pretty serious when you're to the point of signing over your kid's organs. I would think you'd want a pretty concrete decision when you've gotten to that stage.
So you do. This is actually a really interesting topic, and it's one I'm very passionate about because I spent a good portion of my career doing heart transplants. And so for me, this is something that I've been very involved with. And it's the controversy is what actually constitutes death. In the 1970s, we decided in this country that when the brain was dead, when it was irreversibly dead, that the patient was dead. And so there's a difference between being brain dead, which is when the brain is no longer going to function, there's no chance of repair, and clinically dead, which is when the heart stops and the entire body is dead. Because we have organ transplants as part of our medical treatments for end organ failure, whether it's the kidneys, the liver, the heart, whatever, we have this brain death law that allows somebody to be declared as dead so that their organs can ultimately be harvested. Now, the controversy comes in a story like this where how are you certain that somebody is actually brain dead? And it's a challenging thing because there are a number of clinical tests or tests that are done at the bedside by a qualified neurologist or neurosurgeon who make a decision about whether somebody is brain dead. Or you can do tests like an electroencephalogram or EEG, but those aren't always definitive either.
So in this case, what happened to make them suddenly realize that, hey, we better not harvest his organs because he's still alive?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have all the details of what happened with this patient. But what likely happened, and again, this is somewhat speculation, is that he suffered a devastating head injury. And it was thought that based on probably his clinical exam at the time and a variety of scans, probably MRIs or CT scans, that he had irrecoverable brain damage. And his clinical exam probably never improved. And there are certain specific tests that are done to test for both brain function and brain stem function. And if you fail those tests, you're declared brain dead. Now, it sounds like he was in the care of the hospital in the intensive care unit for an extended period of time. And they must have had some degree of uncertainty because right before they were about to sign over his organs, it said that they did a test that showed that he had brain wave activity. So they probably used a variety of both clinical exams and the electroencephalogram or EEG to make a determination. And it sounds like because the EEG had positive activity, they waited to see what would happen, and ultimately he ended up recovering.
Suppose, God forbid, you find yourself in a situation like this. Oh, what kinds of questions should you ask the doctor?
That's a great question, actually. And I think there's a few. One, you need to understand the difference between brain death and a coma. I think the hard thing for people is they see that their loved one is still what appears to be alive. Mm-hmm. They're warm to the touch. Their heart is beating. They see the chest rising and falling as though they're breathing because they're hooked up to the ventilator. And so there are many, many, many signs of life present. This is especially bad if somebody has a big stroke when there's no trauma, and so they've lost their brain function because of a bleed inside of the head or because of an oxygen deprivation injury to the brain, and the brain dies. And brain death occurs when the person has irreversible catastrophic brain injury, which means that there's total cessation of all brain function, both the upper brain structure and the brain stem itself. A coma or a persistent vegetative state, you actually still have brain function and are oftentimes brain stem function. Brain death is not a coma. Brain death is determined by the hospital as being irreversible brain damage. You are not recovering from it. You are essentially dead. This whole ethical issue around death and organ harvest has been one that's existed since we started doing organ transplants. And it's a super important issue because we need to make sure that people are actually dead. But there's a huge shortage of organs that are needed for transplantation. And so it's really important that people actually participate as organ donors so that if, God forbid, they ever become in an accident, they can actually help to keep others alive.
Definition of death was not as definitive as I thought.
No, it's not. It's complicated.
Well, in any case, lucky kid. I wish him well. Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Thank you, Dr. Cohen.
Thanks, Dave.
The big vote is this afternoon in the Seattle City Council. We will cover it live here on Cairo Radio. And ahead of that vote, joining me and Heather. Heather is the president of the Downtown Seattle Association. John Scholes. Is Amazon serious about the pause? If the city council today gets six votes in favor of the $500 head tax, and that's the version that's on the table this afternoon, does the pause in construction become permanent?
We should take this very seriously, and the city policymakers should take this very seriously, because if Amazon pauses in Seattle, it's going to mean lost jobs directly and indirectly, fewer customers for small businesses, and fewer jobs for folks building buildings in our city.
Well, that would solve the problem, though, right? Because the skyrocketing price of housing is being blamed on Amazon's development rampage through South Lake Union. If they pause, then that would take pressure off home prices and people to have homes again.
Well, I'm I'm glad we've got jobs in our city, Dave, jobs in the heart of our city. And there's cities and areas around the country that still haven't required, recovered, I should say, the jobs they lost during the Great Recession. So thankfully, we've got opportunity and prosperity here in Seattle. I want more of it. I want more jobs in our city. I don't think getting rid of jobs or taxing jobs is the answer. We need more housing.
John, there's been a lot of attention on Amazon, of course, and people will look at that and say, well, yeah, they're a big company. They can afford this. But won't this tax affect other businesses? What are you hearing from other companies who might be saying that they can't handle this?
Absolutely. And we've seen that over the last 2 weeks or so in Seattle. Small businesses that understand that, hey, those are my customers. Healthcare professionals that say, hey, those are my patients. And construction workers who get those buildings I'm building, that's my job.
But beyond that, aren't there some businesses like independent grocery stores, for example, who might not be able to handle a $500 per employee tax every year?
Yeah, this tax as proposed would impact hundreds of employers in Seattle. It's not a tax on profits. It's a tax on employing people in the city. So the impact is beyond Amazon, and the legislation can exempt small businesses from paying this tax, but it won't exempt them from the impacts. They will feel it in the form of lost customers and lost revenue.
There was a report in the Seattle Times, the Kinsey report, the McKinsey & Company report, which said, and this is cited by Shama Salwant when she was making her arguments last week, that we need $410 million worth of housing, 14,000 units. How did you read that report? Because according to the Seattle Times version, they weren't just talking about public money. They were talking about a combination of public and private money.
Well, I'd say spending more money is not in itself a strategy. That's what we've been doing here for the last 5 years. More money every year, and we see more and more people outside. So spending money alone is not a strategy in and of itself.
But there's a housing shortage. I mean,
absolutely.
There's a gap. So
we need more housing, and we have too many limits and restrictions on housing within the city of Seattle right now. Amazon and other companies, they've done their job. They've hired employees. They've created opportunity. They're paying wages. They're paying benefits. And we've had incredible job growth in this city. At the same time, we haven't seen the same increase in housing because we have too many limits and too many rules. And that's not Amazon's responsibility. That's City Hall. They control zoning. They control the regulatory
environment. Well, what do developers tell you? Who do you know of people who would build, and it says 14,000 units of affordable housing. Are there developers willing to build affordable housing, or would they just build luxury condos that wouldn't solve the problem?
Well, we need to relax the restrictions on housing we have across the city. It's illegal in about 90% of the city to build apartments. So if you have that condition in place.
It's illegal in 90% of the city to build apartments.
To build apartments and condos. Multifamily housing is restricted to very few areas within the city of Seattle. That is a key part of why we're in the situation we're in, when we've had lots of jobs that have come and the housing hasn't kept up.
Well, have you guys appeared at the council to point this out, to say that, I don't know, I saw that piece in the Times, what was it, last week? There are not many cities that have as much land that is off limits to apartment development as Seattle does.
You're absolutely right. And those conditions have not changed in a material way in the last 6 or 7 years as we've had this significant job growth. The folks who are in charge of that are 9 people at city council, not any company in this city.
So here's the bottom line. If I'm driving through Seattle and it crushes my heart to see people having to live in tents, and I think I'm not alone in that, how do we get, what process do we use to bring the business and the government community together to solve this problem? What is the next step if, in fact, the council votes down this head tax today?
Well, it starts with focusing on the problem of homelessness and what's working well, where do we need to make improvements? That's not where the city council started with this process. They started by saying, how big of a tax do we need on employers in the city of Seattle? That's the wrong approach. It's backwards. It's not going to lead to more effective
results. Do you feel like you can work with the city council, though? Because right now it feels so us versus them.
It does. And in some ways, this business climate's gone from unpredictable to predictably hostile. We long for the days maybe when it was just unpredictable, but in a lot of ways, it's predictably hostile.
Do you have enough ears on the city council that you can talk to, that you think you can negotiate with, maybe talk to the mayor about this, or is it going to go back to us versus them?
Well, I appreciate the efforts of the mayor on this. She's been dealt a difficult hand politically with where a majority of this council seems to want to take this policy. Appreciate the work of the county executive and his leadership. I think we need to have a countywide approach. This is not a Seattle-only issue. We know that about half the people that are currently homeless in the city of Seattle became homeless outside the city limits. We need the rest of the county, the other cities in the county, to come together on a countywide strategy. Seattle cannot do this alone.
John Scholes is the president of the Downtown Seattle Association. John, thank you very much.
Appreciate the opportunity.
And now your daily dose of kindness. Members of a Special Olympics softball team from Lake Stevens got quite the surprise when they turned out for practice recently.
I'd like you guys to give a warm round of a welcome to our friend Chris Pratt.
Actor Chris Pratt, star of Guardians of the Galaxy and Jurassic Park, showed up to hit a few balls and talk with the team.
I'm so happy. I'm a fan of yours too. Yes, sir. I'm from Lake Stevens. You guys are all from Lake Stevens.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say I'm so proud of you guys for representing Lake Stevens at Nationals. Come on.
That's from a video on the fundraising site crowdrise.com, where you can donate to the Special Olympics and win a chance to go to the premiere of Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. And from the looks of the video, the team was having a lot of fun.
You got to get home one.
I'm going to try my best.
2-1.
Oh, nice.
9-1. Let's go, Eagles.
Pratt says he wants to bring awareness to the 17,500 kids and adults with disabilities who participate in the Special Olympics in Washington State. And the group says the money he's helping to raise will go toward equipment, travel expenses, the cost of adding new sports, and serving more people. The Lake City Eagles are set to compete in the Special Olympics USA Games in Seattle this July. And Dave, what I love about this is it looks like he didn't just walk in and make an appearance and take some pictures. He actually got out there and played ball with them and shared, you know, chewing gum, and it did look like a lot of fun.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Before I get to Chuck Knox and the unfortunate injury to Robinson Cano, there was a Supreme Court ruling today on sports betting, Danny, and this was a case brought by New Jersey. It was no contest. The Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that the federal government cannot ban sports betting. Now, we have a ban on sports betting, a state ban on sports betting, correct?
That's correct.
So is this, I mean, has there ever been any talk about lifting that, which would be possible now that the feds have backed off?
I have not seen it. I know that this came up a few years ago when daily fantasy sports was very popular, and Washington was one of the states where you couldn't do that. I don't know what the trickle-down effect will be here. I know that we are about to witness widespread legalized sports gambling. Like, that's going to happen. Whether or not it happens here remains a different question, but certainly the door is open. New Jersey wants to do it. New York wants to do it. This is going to happen, and it's going to be sooner rather than later. And maybe Washington will be one of the only holdouts that doesn't do it, but I would actually think that it's probably going to go in the opposite direction, that eventually Washington will go the way of that I think the rest of the nation is going to head now.
All right, let's talk Mariners. A loss for the team yesterday, and a big loss when it comes to one of the players, Robinson Cano. What do you know about his injury and how long he may be out?
Yeah, I don't know how long he's going to be out. I would say a baseline is 6 to 8 weeks. He broke the fifth metacarpal in his hand. It's his right hand. It's his throwing hand. He was hit by a pitch, and he was in a pretty full cast by the end. His entire forearm was wrapped, and it looked like his his ring finger and his pinky finger were immobilized in the wrap he was wearing after the game. He's going to Philadelphia to see a specialist. This is terrible news. It's absolutely awful. And I guess you can blame the pitcher. Players get hit by thrown balls, and this is just one of those really unfortunate. He's been a remarkably durable player, and it's a real bummer that he's going to be out. I would expect that we're going to see Gordon Beckham called up. He's an infielder currently in AAA Tacoma. He has major league experience. I wondered if they would move D. Gordon from center field to second base. D. Gordon's a previous Gold Glove winning second baseman. We'll see what the move that they make today is, but it's a huge setback.
Is this a kind of injury that you can recover from, or this? I don't want to say it might be career ending, but
he'll be fine once he gets back. It's just that it's a bone in his hand, and it's those are incredibly important for a baseball player for pretty much everything he's going to do. We'll wonder if he's going to be as hot when he gets back. He's been really good both at the plate and in the field so far. It might affect him this season, but this is that's not the kind of injury that will have any sort of long-term impact. It's just that he's probably going to miss, I would guess, 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah. Of all the times for this to happen, they had all this momentum, man.
Yeah, it stinks, man. I was really mad. I wanted somebody to charge the mound and punch the pitcher, but we know how the caveman impulse that I have. Yeah, you take out our second baseman, you get socked.
Let's talk about Chuck Knox. He basically put the Seahawks on the map, didn't he?
Yeah, he was the coach that they brought in the early 80s, replacing Jack Patera for the 83 season. He had an immediate impact. The team went and played, made back-to-back playoff appearances, became a force to be reckoned with here, and he passed away over the weekend in his mid-80s. I believe he was 86. Very tough old-school coach from Swickley, Pennsylvania. He was a tough hombre, and that was the thing. And he had all these sayings like, "I'm going to speak real quiet so you can listen real hard. Don't tell me how stormy the sea is. Just bring the ship to shore." They became called Knoxisms because he had a saying for pretty much everything.
Didn't they call him Ground Chuck?
Ground Chuck was his nickname because he loved running the ball. And then Kurt Warner blew out his knee in the first day of the 1984 season, and he became Air Knox, and they let Craig just throw it around. It was absolutely the when you see the direction that the franchise had gone, he made a philosophy switch mid-season after that injury to Chuck Knox, or after that injury to Kurt Warner, and they absolutely remained the same level of success.
So how many coaches are left who use that old school style?
Well, Pete definitely does. There's not as many. The league has certainly become a more pass-oriented league. There's no doubt about that. But you'll still see the 49ers a few years ago under Jim Harbaugh. They were a run-based offense, but it's significantly less common now.
Yeah. All right. So I guess our challenge here is to figure out what superstition we can invoke to speed up Robinson Cano's recovery.
Well, you believe in voodoo? Is that what you're saying? Dave, you seem like a man of medicine. You're an Ivy League educated individual.
Let's be honest. We'll do anything.
We're talking about baseball here.
We should get some sort of poultice.
Yeah.
Like some sort of poultice to apply to his hand.
Chicken bones around the neck, maybe?
Yeah, want to spit in the mud around second base and make it into a nice poultice and apply it to his wrist.
Yeah. I expected more from you, Dave. This is no time for hocus pocus.
No, we're desperate now. We're just desperate.
Just need an orthopedic surgeon.
We go live to Israel. In Jerusalem, there are celebrations, but at the Gaza border, protesters are being shot by Israelis defending the border. Let's go to CBS News correspondent Robert Berger. Robert, why are they using live ammunition on protesters? Are the protesters armed?
Well, according to the Israelis, a few of them are. Most of them are not, but there are thousands of people trying to storm across the border fence into Israel, which would pose a major security threat to Israel.
Yeah.
So they're saying, the Israeli army is, that anyone approaching the fence and trying to break it down is risking his own life, and they have been using live fire to prevent them from crossing the border. You could have mobs, you could have people armed with perhaps knives, and of course, there are a lot of armed terrorists in Gaza who could also come in with the crowd. So Israel drew a red line. It's been a very bloody day.
Yeah. Hamas is saying that over 40 have been killed. Does that sound accurate to you?
Yes, that's the number, at least 40, which is the highest death toll we've seen in 7 weeks of these weekly protests. They've been normally taking place on Friday. They were due to culminate with the opening of the embassy today, and also tomorrow, a Palestinian national day known as the Nakba, or catastrophe of Israel's creation. So a very tense time here as the embassy opens.
And what kind of offense is this? I thought there was actually a concrete wall, but this is what, barbed wire or slats, or what is it?
Seems like not such a sturdy fence. A good point. I mean, the wall you're talking about, most of the wall that everyone's seen pictures of is in the West Bank. There are parts of Gaza that have a wall, but most of it is a fence that they've been trying to break down. And as I said, you know, the Israelis saying that's a red line that can't be crossed.
Okay, I've seen various reports this morning that Israelis welcome the relocation of the embassy. It's about time. And then there are others who are saying that this is going to stop the peace process dead because apparently the location of the embassy, well, actually for a long time, the location of the embassy has been a negotiating point, hasn't it?
Well, the issue of Jerusalem certainly has been the negotiating point. Supposedly, it was left for final status talks. In other words, one of the last issues to be resolved, and that's why the Americans and nobody else wanted to move their embassies here. Then President Trump decided, well, to see to, and he said in his speech today via video at the opening that, you know, every country has a right to choose its capital, Israel included. He said it's a long time coming, and that it was the right thing to do.
So does this nudge the peace process forward, or does it just stop it dead? It's already been stopped, I guess, hasn't it?
Well, you know, interestingly, President Trump said the embassy is a symbol of the partnership between the U.S. and Israel in the pursuit of peace. Obviously, the Palestinians don't see it that way. They see Jerusalem as a capital, as the capital of a future state. Let's remember that in addition to being the holiest place in Judaism, as well as Christianity, you know, this is the third holiest place in Islam as well, with the Dome of the Rock up there on what the Jews call the Temple Mount. So the Palestinians also have claims to the city.
Right. And as for the Israeli Arabs, what has their stand on this been?
The Israeli Arabs tend to side with the Palestinians. They think that this was the wrong thing to do. They believe that also, you know, that Jerusalem should basically be the capital of two peoples, which is what the international community has been pursuing, meaning both the capital of Israel and of a Palestinian state.
Well, and is this, but the embassy doesn't prevent that. I mean, we could open up a Palestinian wing of the embassy if necessary. I mean, what would be the problem there?
They feel that that by recognizing Jerusalem, the Palestinians do, and also the Europeans, by the way, and certainly the Arab world, they believe that this should be decided in negotiations, and until it is, the embassies should remain in Tel Aviv. But President Trump says he's simply recognizing reality. I mean, and every leader that comes here, whether it's the Europeans or the Americans or anybody else, where did they meet Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu? In Jerusalem.
Right.
And where's the Knesset, Israel's parliament? Here in Jerusalem. So President Trump saying this is simply a recognition of reality and urging other nations to follow suit.
CBS correspondent Robert Berger, live from Jerusalem. Robert, thank you.
Thank you, Dave.